Chapter 8, The Other Side of Winter. The summer at Baton Rouge did not end by becoming cool. It ended because the army moved us again. A soldier learns that seasons in the South are not marked as they are at home. In Wisconsin, the summer begins to yield by signs a farmer can trust. The evenings take a different edge. The fields change color. The talk turns toward cutting, storing, mending, laying in, and the long preparation for cold. In Louisiana and along the Gulf, heat seemed less like a season than a country we had entered. It held us after the calendar said it should loosen. The sun had its authority, and the army had its own. We left the slow life of Baton Rouge for another kind of movement. The regiment had waded through weeks of drill, guard, fatigue duty, washing in the river, Sunday meetings, and mail watched for as if the boats themselves could speak. By August, the war drew us toward Mobile Bay. We did not know, as men know afterward, which movements would be remembered and which would pass into the common ledger of service. We knew only that we were ordered, and when a regiment is ordered, it gathers itself out of all the small arrangements it has made for living. The bow shelters, the places of shade, the paths to the water, the familiar tents and talk of Baton Rouge, all were left behind. A camp is temporary, yet men inhabit it truly while they are there. They drive stakes, they hang clothing, they learn where the sun will strike first and where the ground stays dry. They know which man snores, which man shares tobacco, which man complains before breakfast, which man grows quiet when no letter comes. Then the order arrives, and the whole little world is folded into knapsacks and wagons. The Mobile Bay expedition belonged to a wider design than any private soldier could see from the ranks. The Union already held the Mississippi. New Orleans had long been occupied. But Mobile remained a Confederate port, guarded by bay, fort, water, and earthwork. To those who read the papers, Mobile stood with Wilmington and a few other places as one of the remaining doors through which the rebellion drew strength from the world. A door does not have to be open wide to matter. If goods, arms, money, and hope pass through it, the war is lengthened. We were infantry. We understood the movement by the things infantry understands. Where we were put, when we were loaded, when we were landed, how much we carried, whether water could be had, whether the enemy was near, and whether mail could follow. Newspapers might speak in great sentences about forts and fleets. The soldier's body spoke in smaller ones. The pack is heavy. The sand gives underfoot. The water is brackish. The sun is high. The order is to move. I had already seen enough of river war to know that ships could be trapped as helplessly as men. At Alexandria, the fleet above the falls had waited on timber, water, and the labor of thousands of hands. At Mobile Bay, the Navy stood again at the center of the matter, but in another fashion. Guns, forts, channels, torpedoes, and ships belonged to the work there. The infantry watched, waited, guarded, moved where sent, and understood only part of what the Navy dared. Men later would remember the Admiral's bold words more readily than the long, humid labor of the troops around the bay. But the Army was there also. The war did not divide neatly between water and land. It used both, and used the men who stood beside both. The old regiment had known Vicksburg before I joined it. It had known the Red River before I fully understood what service would cost. By the time we were sent toward Mobile, I no longer felt myself simply a late man catching up to veterans. I had marched with them in retreat. I had stood in the Louisiana heat with them. I had waited for mail with them. The Army makes belonging in harsh ways. It does not ask whether one has earned affection. It asks whether one keeps place when the line moves. There is a difference between entering danger and entering uncertainty. Danger has a shape when the guns begin. Uncertainty is larger. It lies before the guns. It belongs to rumors, boats, orders, camps shifted, rations drawn, commanders named, commanders doubted, and men calculating in their heads how far they are from home. In the late summer of 1864, that uncertainty stretched from Baton Rouge to the Gulf and then back into the interior of the South. The regiment's record carries the dates simply. Mobile Bay Expedition, August 18th to September 2nd, 1864. A line like that is useful, but it is thin. It cannot show what a man carried from the July heat into the August movement. It cannot show how the mind kept returning to Wisconsin even while the body was sent toward Alabama waters. It cannot show a wife opening one letter and waiting for another, while other women in the same community did the same.
Looking back from Edward Bennett at 70, a service record is a narrow bridge over a wide stream. It will carry the dates if a man steps carefully, but it will not carry the weight of the days. When I was old and the war had become a thing men asked about as history, I knew how easily a campaign name could stand where a life had been. Mobile Bay, Morganza, Helena. The words fit on a line. The living of them did not.
After the expedition, the regiment's course turned again through Louisiana operations, Morganza and Bayou Sara, and then to Helena, Arkansas. The names changed, but the condition of the soldier did not change as much as a reader might think. We were still in the South, still under orders, still far from home, still exposed to sickness as surely as to bullets. The great battles had their thunder, but garrison and movement had their own wearing sound, the steady scrape of duty against the body and the mind. At Helena, the war narrowed and widened at the same time. It narrowed because daily duty could seem small. Guard, roll call, drill, fatigue, rations, letters, inspection, Sunday, sickness, rumor. It widened because the longer a man remained away, the more home entered every quiet hour. When the army does not fill the day with marching, the farm comes forward. The children come forward. The wife comes forward. The price of pork, the keeping of hay, the sickness of a neighbor, the draft in Wisconsin, the question whether a child obeys his mother, all come into camp and sit beside the musket. The October fragment that remains from my hand is not a battle account. It is, in some ways, more revealing. Battles can make men sound alike because fear and duty press them into similar shapes. Domestic worry returns a man to himself. In that fragment, I was a soldier writing from the South, but I was also husband, father, farmer, neighbor, and churchman. I was thinking of what could be eaten, what could be kept, what must not be sold, who might be drafted, who had spoken cruelly, who needed discipline, who needed a kiss. I wrote of the children first as children, not as figures in a record. Lizzie and James were going to school. James wanted, as boys do, to be a man before he had learned obedience enough to be one. Sarah Ann and Eddie were small enough to live in my mind by motion and mischief. Of Eddie, the fragment preserves the kind of little complaint that is dear because it is ordinary. I wrote, "I think he looks roguish. It's too bad he bites." There is no campaign map that can hold such a sentence. Yet to a father in Arkansas, it may carry more life than the name of a fort. I wanted Janet to know that I saw her labor, even from far away. I think of all the work you have to do. I often think I see you busy as a bee, especially on Saturdays. But don't hurt yourself with work. Don't do it for the sake of me. A man can write such words and still leave the work to be done by the woman who receives them. That is one of the hard truths of wartime letters. They comfort, but they do not milk a cow. They advise, but they do not split wood. They send love, but they do not lift a child from a mother's arms when she is tired. The farm matters in that fragment have the sound of winter coming. Poor crops. Food to keep. Nothing to sell if it could be avoided. Flour, wheat, rye, oats, beans, potatoes, hay. These were not merely items in a list. They were the difference between managing and failing, between depending on purchase and surviving on what the farm could hold. Prices had risen. Labor was short. Men were away. Those at home had to make one season answer for another. I told Janet, "Don't sell any kind of food you have. Don't sell any flour or wheat, rye, oats, beans, or potatoes, if it is possible to keep them. I think you will need all you have before any more can be raised. It is a long time to SEP 1865. That last sentence shows how the war measured itself inside me then. September 1865 stood ahead as a far ridge. I did not know what would happen before it. I did not know that I would be held beyond the regiment's main muster out. I knew only that a household had to last. The cow had a place in that same economy. If Julia was fat, I thought it best to kill her. Such advice may sound plain almost to hardness, but a farm family knew the calculation. An animal was not sentiment only. It was feed, winter, meat, milk, value, and need. To decide such things by letter was clumsy and late. Yet I tried. Every instruction I sent across the miles was already old by the time it arrived. Janet had the living facts. I had memory, judgment, and anxiety.
From the other side of the letter, this time the other side is not silence only. Janet's own preserved words answer from Moundville. I was very anxious to get a letter from you this week, as it has been reported here that your regiment has left Helena, but there was no letters for any of us here from your company. Sarah Ann and Mrs. Elliott got one, but I have not heard where the letter was from. I do hope this report is not true. The rumor reached the house before the husband did. Other women had letters. Janet did not. That is a whole day of war in one sentence.
Janet's letter of December 30th opens the homeward side of the chapter more fully than any reconstruction could. Until then, we had mostly my side of the conversation. My hand reached north. My questions, my advice, my longing, my religious hope, my farm instructions, my requests for kisses, my reports of health and movement. But her letter shows what those words meant. It shows a household listening for news, comparing letters with neighbors, measuring rumor against absence. She had heard that the regiment had left Helena. The report was not true in the way she feared, but she could not know that when she wrote. To a soldier, a move might mean packing, marching, and orders. To a wife, a move might mean no mail, danger, sickness, battle, or a silence with no explanation. If another wife received a letter and she did not, the absence itself became news. It is easy for a man in camp to write, "I will write when I can." It is harder for the woman at home to live inside the days when he cannot. The December letter also carried a strange return of my own words by way of England. Janet had received a newspaper from my father, and at first she was disappointed because it was not a letter from me. Then she opened it and found that one of my letters had been printed in the Berry Times, sent by my father in Lancashire. The paper said that James Bennett had sons and grandsons fighting in the cause of union and emancipation. That phrase matters. It names the war as some in our family and old country circle understood it. Union, yes, but emancipation also. I had left Lancashire as a young man, crossed into America, made my life in Wisconsin, buried one wife, married another, raised children, farmed, joined a Wisconsin regiment, and wrote home from camps and rivers. Yet a letter of mine could cross back over the sea and appear in the place from which I had come. That is one of the quiet astonishments of the record. A soldier thinks he is writing to his wife. His father sends the words farther. A newspaper prints them. A town in England reads of an American war through the hand of a man born near them.
Looking back from the diary in the bound volume, I did not understand when I wrote those letters how far a plain sheet might travel. I wrote to Janet because she was my wife, because the children were mine, because home needed to know whether I was alive and where I might be. If my father put one of those letters before readers in Barrie, then my words made another journey back across the water I had crossed as a young man. I had gone out from Lancashire to America. In war, a part of my voice went back.
Janet was pleased by it. She wrote that she would take good care of the paper. Her sentence is difficult in the transcription, but the feeling is plain enough. The printed letter was not the same as receiving a fresh letter from her husband, but it carried him in another form. It told her that his words had mattered beyond the household. It tied the Bennett family in Wisconsin, the Bennett father in Lancashire, and the Union Army together on a single sheet. Her letter also shows how war news entered the house mixed with rumor, politics, family talk, and Christmas. She had heard that old Jeff had been poisoned, a false rumor about Jefferson Davis. She had heard of desertion to Canada. Her mother had read that the war might be settled in 6 months. Such reports came through newspapers, neighbors, letters, and talk, and no one at home could sort them with certainty. The soldier had his rumors in camp. The wife had hers in the kitchen, at the post office, and among kin. Christmas had passed. Janet did not describe it as merry for herself. The transcription leaves gaps where the page is damaged or the words are uncertain, but enough remains to show the children had enjoyed it. There had been a soldier's wife's party at Mrs. Ellison's on the Monday after Christmas. The very phrase carries the period in it. A party for soldiers' wives is both fellowship and admission. It gathers women by absence. It makes a social occasion out of a shared lack. Lizzie's page stands inside that December letter like a small lamp. Her spelling is uncertain. Some words are hard to read. She writes as a child writes, reaching toward the father who is both real and distant. She was pleased with his letter. She tells of Christmas, waking before daylight, stockings, nuts, candies, and a doll. There is much in her page that cannot yet be read with full confidence, and we must not make it say more than it does. But the fact of the page is powerful enough. My daughter had taken up the pen. The child I had asked Janet to teach, the girl whose reading mattered to me in Baton Rouge, was now writing back. A man can miss many things in war, and not all of them are dramatic. He can miss a child's hand changing on paper. He can miss the first time a sentence becomes steady. He can miss the small pride with which a daughter signs her own name. The army records none of that. The family papers do. Janet resumed after Lizzie. The weather was very cold. Snow had come, and a freeze after it. She was kept busy, and time passed faster than she expected because there was so much to do. Her mother was often sick. When both women were sick, it came hard on Janet to know how to get along. Her father was kept busy chopping firewood and doing chores. The boys liked the wood first rate. Taxes were not as high as expected because the school matter had been left out through some blunder. There is no need to invent Janet's burden. She states it. Cold, sickness, children, wood, chores, taxes, rumor, letters, a mother unwell, a husband away, and a war whose end is promised by newspapers but not yet delivered by fact. That is the winter side of Helena. While we stood guard in Arkansas, that was the guard she kept in Wisconsin. For me, Helena became a place of waiting, but not empty waiting. The regiment was held there from October into February. The war beyond us was moving toward its last great pressures. Sherman had taken Atlanta and would march through Georgia. Grant still pressed Lee in Virginia. The presidential election had passed. The North had not given up. Men in camp knew pieces of these things through papers and rumor. We understood that the war was narrowing toward decision, though no private soldier could say where or when the end would break open. But the daily life of the regiment did not become grand because the war was grand. Men still sickened. Men still stood guard. Men still washed clothes, wrote letters, complained of rations, watched officers, and speculated about orders. The South in winter did not resemble Wisconsin winter, but it had discomforts of its own. Damp, river air, mud, chills, sickness, and the weariness of remaining under military rule long after the first excitement of enlistment had gone out of a man. The draft at home troubled the communities from which we came. I wrote, "I hope John Ellis will escape the draft. He has paid his share." That sentence may seem curious unless one remembers how local obligation worked in those years. Towns had quotas. Men paid bounties. Families measured fairness by who had gone, who had paid, who had stayed, and who might yet be taken. I did not write like a man eager to see every neighbor forced into uniform. I wrote like one who knew the burden had already fallen in particular ways and that households kept account of sacrifice. There was bitterness in the home news, too. The fragment preserves a harsh story of Bob Keene speaking cruelly to Mrs. Peake when she received word that Peake was dead. The meaning of the quarrel is not fully clear. It may have concerned enlistment, town quotas, or some other community grievance. What is clear is the tone. War did not make every neighbor kinder. Death could be met with pity, but it could also become the occasion for old resentment. A soldier far away hears such talk by letter and is reminded that the home front is not an image of pure peace. It has its own wounds. I was in good health when I closed that fragment, and I hoped the same for home. Such closings can sound repeated because soldiers repeated them often, but repetition does not make them empty. Health was the daily mercy. In a regiment where disease had taken and would take more men than bullets, to be able to write that one was well was no small word. To hope that wife and children were the same was to ask for the one news that mattered before all others. The chapter of autumn and winter was therefore not a pause between campaigns. It was a crossing of another sort. We crossed from the failures and endurance of 1864 toward the final campaign of 1865. At home, Janet crossed from harvest worry into winter keeping. Lizzie crossed from being spoken of in her father's letters to writing in her own hand. My words crossed from Arkansas to Wisconsin, and one of them, by my father's doing, crossed from America back to England. If the Book of War were written only by battles, this season might be passed over quickly. But a man's service is not made only in battle. A family does not wait only on battle days. Helena, the October fragment, Janet's December letter, and Lizzie's childish page show another war, the one made of absence lengthened until it becomes ordinary and therefore more dangerous to the heart. Men can prepare themselves for a charge. It is harder to prepare the soul for another month, another rumor, another empty post office day, another Saturday of work, another child growing while the father is away. By February, the long waiting began to give way. The regiment would leave Helena and turn again toward New Orleans and then toward Alabama. The final campaign was forming, though we could not yet know it as final. We had passed through summer heat, Gulf movement, Louisiana duty, Arkansas garrison, autumn farm worry, and Christmas at a distance. Ahead lay pine woods, sand, swamp, Spanish Fort, Blakely, Mobile, and the end of the war as it came to us. But before that last movement, the winter had done its work. It had shown what the uniform could not contain. A man may belong to a regiment, but he also belongs to a table, a field, a wife, a child's lesson, a cow in the barn, a stack of hay, a mother-in-law sick in the house, a father chopping wood, a newspaper from England, and a daughter writing her name. The army had not taken those things from me. It had made me feel how far away they were.